Cultures around the world have always looked to nature as a source of both increased health and wellness. While modern science continues to support this connection, we spend the majority of our time indoors. Welcome to the Nature of Wellness podcast, where we explore the relationship between the natural world and the human experience. Join us as we discuss all things nature, health, and well-being. We truly believe the future of health is now.
Welcome to another episode of the Nature of Wellness podcast. I'm Dr. Mark Campbell, and with me is one of my all-time favorite people, someone who makes me better with every interaction, someone who walks the talk daily, my favorite co-host, Mr. Steve Otero. How are you, Steve?
Hey, man. I'm going to be honest. I got to change up my response this time. I'm actually feeling fairly under the weather today.
Yeah.
But I am grateful to be able to still, you know, to still be able to work, right? But the privilege of the internet, of computers, of mobile recording equipment, lots of hot tea, lemon. I got a lot of honey hook cough drops. So, you know, I'm not getting anybody else sick.
No, how are you, man? I'm good, man. And I almost said that in my intro about you, that even when you're not at your best, you're better than most.
Just trying, right?
Yeah. And the husky voice will be a little huskier today. That's all that means.
Sure.
How's everything going out in Colorado weather-wise? I know we're getting deep into the season now.
Well, I mean, we've been a little low. We started the season slow, but Crested Butte seems to, we're getting hit with like these sporadic weeks of nothing, no snow. And then all of a sudden we get 17 inches.
Wow.
And, you know, in the course of 2 days. And so that's a little funny, observing the weather patterns change. You know, I've lived here going on 9 years, and it's interesting just to see, even in that short amount of time, the weather has changed significantly. So less snow, but when we do get it, it's in like these huge, huge chunks, which makes it pretty fun, but the snow otherwise gets pretty crusty and icy and kind of funky. So I'm praying for more snow so we have good water, you know, in the spring, right? Obviously, I live at the headwaters, and we feed almost half the entire western chunk of the United States through the Colorado River. So my fingers are always crossed for more snow.
It's funny how I'm hearing that from people all over the country about the weird weather patterns. And every year it seems to be more and more of a conversation, which, again, non-political show, but you can't argue that there are changes happening. And again, I just hope that we can be adults and sit down and listen to one another without any ulterior motives or any other benefit expected, except for us moving forward as a species together safely. So yeah, it's the same here, man. I can't remember the last time we had a big snow here. I mean, I moved to the DC area in 2011, and I remember walking to work in a pretty good snowstorm then. And we've had a couple big ones here and there, but I mean, nothing like we used to. I think the last biggest one was 4 or 5 years ago, which is crazy. Everybody keeps saying this is going to be a bad winter. We'll see. We could use some water here too. My thigh deep wading with fly fishing has been more like ankle deep for a while now. So,
wow.
Yeah. So looking to get some of the rivers flowing bigger again. But yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for the quiet. I'm ready for the solitude of the season. You know, we talked about that last year, really finding the beauty and the peace outside during the winter. Actually, one of my favorite times to be outside. Cold is cold. If you're prepared, cold isn't that bad, but
yeah,
you know, you can't beat the solitude. And again, like I always joke, seeing Mother Nature with her makeup off and seeing, you know, the rocks and the mountains and everything you can't see when the trees have leaves, and seeing what the landscape really looks like. It's just beautiful if you know what to look for.
I know I'm still out there practicing casting, you know, and I'm practicing casting more, I think, even now, just because there's less fisher people out there on the water, you know? And so it kind of gives me, you know what, I guess it does. It gives me that additional little barrier of preventing my own little personal embarrassment, right? I don't claim to be an expert, but I do claim to love going fishing. I love going to be able to just, you know, stand there and be out there on the water. And, you know, practice is fun. You know, that part of it has always been fun to me. So I'm trying to take advantage of the fact that I have, you know, good dry suit, high quality boots. And actually, I'm really stoked that, you know, my spouse got a dry suit this season. And I'm really looking forward to doing some winter boating with her. Nice. You know, she and I can practice together and do a little, like, 8-foot raft. And the thing is perfect. It's absolutely perfect. It's great for two people. And, you know, one person can paddle, or one person can be on the oars and the other person can fish. Or we, you know, we take the oar frame off and, you know, we seat across from each other and we both paddle. And we have some amazing, you know, waters out here any time of year. And so low flow just gives us a different environment to practice within. So I'm looking forward to that too.
That's outstanding, man. And, you know, I wanted to share in the intro, I had the opportunity to do something that you do often with your job. And I used to do a lot more often in previous positions, but I got a chance to go out this week to a farm a couple hours north of here and hang out with some U.S. Marine Corps wounded, ill, and injured folks and do some dog and equine therapy.
Oh, wow. And,
you know, it was great. It was cold, but we were in a little show barn inside and everybody had so much fun. And I know that horses have always been a big part of my life growing up. And I know you and I have talked about the power of equine therapy, especially with veteran populations. A lot more research is being done with that population. As we always say, a lot of medical advances come out of the military in times of conflict.
For sure.
So that's definitely where a lot of the research is coming out. But, you know, what are your thoughts on equine therapy?
I mean, it's something that I'm so grateful my children have become very excited to participate in. You know, they have been going horseback riding now every summer for a few summers in a row. And I have not personally participated in equine therapy. I've helped, you know, facilitate the organization of certain equine events, right, as like a part of a conference for other veterans and things like that. But I know every time I'm around horses, I'm very, very excited. I feel like more naturally relaxed around them. And I geek out about the research related, right, to all these different interventions or potential interventions, right? And, you know, we're thankfully science is acknowledging that more of these activities that some might label as recreation only, right? Many of these activities go well beyond just the idea of recreation. Not that they have to be valuable. However, finding and discovering, right, these additional layers of value seems pretty cool. There was a study that came out in 2021, and it was about horse therapy helping veterans overcoming trauma, right? And it came out of a Columbia University Irving Medical Center. And I didn't know this, but made assumptions, which are dangerous, but I thought others maybe had already started this research. But someone, they led this first university-led study to evaluate equine-assisted therapy in treating veterans with PTSD. And they're specifically engaged in this study so that they could develop a manual to promote protocols and guide others, both the professionals that are leading the therapy, as well as providing a guide to any interested potential therapy participants, right? And so help welcome them in with warm hands. And, you know, a key finding in the therapy is that they discovered that equine therapy facilitates bonding, both group as well as human animal bonding, overcoming fear and reestablishing personal confidence, which, right, as we all know, is very, very valuable, especially in our world of hustle culture. We all got to have a little bit of confidence to make it through. Right. Sometimes, unfortunately, we have that phrase, what, fake it till you make it.
Oh yeah. Dangerous.
We could debate that one all day. I guess it has worked for some in the past, depending on perspective. But I guess you could say I'm trying to right now, you know, kind of faking it till I make it, I guess. Feeling sick today. But, you know, I thought that was really, really cool, right? Columbia, major, major university, sort of leading the way with attempting to establish protocols for best practices in equine therapy for veterans. Something I'm just so, so happy and excited to share with the world.
Yeah, I love that, man. And so many of those programs and studies have come across my desk, especially in the last position I had with the DOD. And I was always amazed at how many people wanted to offer up their farms and their ranches and their horses because they understand the power. Anecdotally, this is before a lot of the science came out. And the farm I was at, I'm hoping that we can have the owner on a later episode just to talk about the programs. I know beside the work they do with veterans, she also said she works with children of all ability levels. They do a lot of DEIB type stuff using horses, which is great. I've always said a horse is a mirror for our emotions. You can't fake the funk with horses, right?
Yep. They know.
They know. And, you know, they are a great gauge of where we're at emotionally. And I saw, if I could share one quick anecdotal observation from the other day, we were broken up into groups and there was a young service member who was in my group with the horse, and we had the youngest horse in the barn. So there are its own challenges, kind of like a toddler.
Sure.
And I found out later he'd had a bad experience with horses before, younger in his life. And he was terrified to get near the stall, terrified to, when we got in the stall, myself and the other guy in the group, and within 45 minutes, he had gotten in the stall. He had walked the horse out, walked it around the barn, brushed it, shampooed its mane. And he must have hugged this horse at least 15 times in 45 minutes. And he said, I've never been around horses. I wouldn't have come today if I really thought we were going to do more than the dogs. He said, but I can't wait to come back. Can I please come back?
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
You know, it was so cool. And for the people listening, Steve, I know you've got hundreds of stories like that over the years. And I've got hundreds of stories like that where you get to see the light bulb come on, especially in that population that doesn't always allow themselves to be vulnerable. But you put them outside, you put them with elements of the natural world, and it's that great equalizer that we always talk about. It's a blank canvas that's safe. So it was just a fun experience, and I hope we can talk to the farm owner a little bit later and find out exactly what they do, because these programs are everywhere. And we're all about helping people figure out how to be outside, whether it's recreation, whether it's just sitting outside. I talked to a gentleman last night who's about to have a serious cardiac surgery. And I was helping him with the mental and emotional side. And the last thing I said was sit outside for 20 minutes a day, preferably under a tree. And I explained to him the science behind it. And he was blown away. So whatever we can do to help people, all kinds of people, get outside, enjoy nature, be part of the natural world, that's our mission. And to see it happen, wow, it's amazing.
I say, question one, are you human? Right. If you can check that box, are you human? Right. Then the outdoors is for you.
Yeah, you belong out there. So I think this is a perfect segue for our guest today, who I know I've been super excited. As soon as I was told I needed to meet this guy, first of all, the person who told me that is somebody I trust completely. And, you know, I love the phrase, he gets it or she gets it. And as soon as I hear that, I don't ask any other questions. So when I heard that this guy gets it, I became very excited. And then had a chance to talk to him a couple of weeks ago, and it was just, he blew my mind. Exceeded any expectations I had as a human being with the work he's doing. So our guest today is Sav Sankaran. Sav is a first-generation American, a passionate hunter and angler, and a nationally acclaimed touring bluegrass musician. Steve, I'm from Kentucky. You know, I love my bluegrass.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I love bluegrass.
He's been an associate at the Orvis Company for over a decade, is a founding member of Orvis's Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee, JEDI. So he is the JEDI master there.
Awesome.
A board member of the Minority Outdoor Alliance, who was a guest last year, Ashley and Darrell Smith, and helps to lead Orvis's DEI and engagement efforts, helping the company to make the outdoors and the outdoor industry more inclusive. Sav is a proud Penn State Nittany Lion and also holds a diversity and inclusion certificate from Cornell University. I couldn't be happier to have you here today, Sav. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
Oh, thanks, guys. I'm really excited. Thanks so much for inviting me. And yeah, just really excited to get into it.
Absolutely. And one thing I will say, as we are usually the two most bearded people on the call, when my beard says its prayers at night, Sav, it's hoping to wake up looking like your beard. So just know that.
It is a beautiful beard.
It's magnificent. And I don't mind saying that on the air.
I've got what they call a face for radio.
Oh, me too. I say it every day. The beard hides a lot of ugly. But Sav, would you mind taking a minute and just talking a bit about your background and your journey and how you got to where you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. So yeah, thanks again for inviting me to tell my story. I think it's just exciting to have the opportunity. So as you mentioned in the intro, I'm a first generation American. My parents are immigrants from India. They immigrated to the United States back in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, I grew up in rural central Pennsylvania, which is where my parents settled before I was born. And as far as a pathway to where I am now, kind of the most important thing about that aspect of it is just the fact that where I grew up is a very rural area. I grew up in the mountains, Allegheny Mountains in central Pennsylvania. As I was growing up, pursuing activities in the outdoors, whether it was fishing, hunting, hiking, whatever, was kind of the thing that people did, essentially. I grew up in an area that was, very much of a monoculture, if you will. Like I said, very rural, very white, so not a lot of touch points for me culturally. One of the things that I think is common to the experience of a lot of people in that situation who are children of immigrants is this idea that you are sort of caught in the middle, if you will. You're at distance from your family's culture, and you're also othered from the majority culture. And there's a space there that needs to be filled, and people fill it in a lot of different ways. For me, that space was filled in a lot of ways by getting involved in the outdoors. I didn't have the awareness or knowledge of the lexicon at that point to really understand that. So for someone who is in that position and trying to find that key to identity, for me, it was all about, at that time as a child, it was just, I wanted to hang out with my buddies and do what they were doing and find a way to fit in. And something I've talked about over the years is that has been recontextualized for me as I've gotten older, because at the time it was the thing I was doing to push my otherness, if you will, away at arm's length. But what I've learned through this journey, as becoming an adult and getting involved in the outdoor industry and all of that, is that it was really a pathway for me to examine the wholeness of my identity rather than push it away. So that's something that's been really impactful for me. Yeah. So anyway, back to the kind of the nuts and bolts of it, fell in love with the outdoors, particularly fly fishing and upland hunting, and was always kind of in the background of what I was doing. Went on to pursue other things. Music is another big passion, something I've followed throughout. It's been a through line in my life. And I know we'll get into that later, but it was always in the background. It was always something that I did to reconnect with the center of myself, and all of that, but never really had any intention of making my career in the outdoor industry. I hung out at a lot of fly shops when I was in college and did a lot of different things, guided, did some instruction, that kind of thing. But again, never had any intention of it becoming my career. Fast forward, moved to the mountains of Southern Appalachia to pursue music full time. And, there's a great, certainly a great center. I'm based in Asheville, North Carolina. Folks know where that is.
Great town.
Great center for Appalachian music and culture. And so, yeah, moved here sort of with the intention of checking it out. Mark, I know when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, I made this comment, and it's something I say a lot, is I moved here for 6 months, and that was 16 years ago. Just fell in love with the area, found a community here. And as far as the East Coast is concerned, this is the place to be. We're surrounded by 1 million acres of public land. Anything you want to do, whether it's fishing, hunting, hiking, mountain biking, whitewater, it's all here. So it really is a playground for folks that love the outdoors. So that was certainly part of what drew me here, and found myself in a position where I had some free time and decided that I was going to start working super part-time at our Orvis retail store here in Asheville. Certainly was a company that I was aware of being involved in the outdoors and never intended for it to be anything more than that. I was like, hey, I've got some free time. I get a sweet discount on some gear. it was gear that I was going to buy anyway, so might as well. And so that was kind of my in at Orvis initially. And then pretty quickly realized that this was something that I felt really good about. Fell in love with the corporate culture at Orvis. It's a company that really walks the walk as far as protecting the places that they love and also creating experiences for people in the outdoors, which is really at the core of the brand. which is something that I felt passionate about. And one of the reasons I wanted to work in the shop is just so I could share the things that I love with other people. So that was the beginning of it. And, you know, from there, went on to do other things within the retail division at Orvis. And at the same time, was in a place in my personal journey where I was starting to realize that my place in industry and the benefits that that allowed me also came with a responsibility to weigh light for other people. And, you know, as I said, this was a time in my life where I was starting to understand the barriers to access to the outdoors. I was starting to understand the experiences that I had had in my life. You know, being a person of color, being someone who didn't have family who were involved in the outdoors, you know, a lot of intersectional kind of identity pieces that came together to present those barriers throughout my journey. And so I was starting to understand that within myself and also realizing that I didn't see representation of people who looked like me or who had my same experience kind of in the greater ecosystem of the outdoor industry. And so, you know, being someone who fancies myself a lifelong learner and, you know, a perpetual student, I just wanted to educate myself more. This is kind of pre-racial reckoning, 2020, all that kind of stuff, but was starting to understand that there were resources out there essentially for me to understand how I could better affect change and also to just learn on my own. And so started to really find a passion for it. That's really how my journey into becoming, you know, a DEI practitioner began. Started to pursue education on my own. I'm a voracious reader, so I just tried to read anything I could get my hands on and was starting to see that come to the forefront within the industry as well, and started to reach out to other folks who were doing amazing work. And as I said, just really found myself with a passion for it in everything, whether it's retail or music or the outdoors. For me, it's all about connection. It's about creating that culture of connection with people, sharing experiences. And this just felt like a really natural way to do that. And so started to get more involved in this work, more specifically at Orvis, internally and externally. And the company invested in me, both kind of emotional capital and physical capital, allowed me to pursue some tertiary education. That program that I did at Cornell that you mentioned at the top of the show was done with Orvis's support.
Awesome.
And so was just finding different ways to engage in that space. And this was kind of around the same time that the committee that you mentioned, that internal work group at Orvis, was formed. And so, yeah, just finding any touch point I could to try to just bring other people along, essentially, is really at the core of it. And so there was a recognition from that group that there needed to be someone whose job it was essentially to lead this work. You know, it's very intentional at Orvis that this work be centered in everything that we do. It feels very organic to who we are as a company. As I said, like, our legacy is, you know, 160 plus years of creating experiences for people outdoors. And this is just a modern iteration of that. And so it's just reimagining what those pathways were through the industry, for our customers, for our associates to engage. And yeah, so, you know, long story short, there was a process by which my current role was kind of ideated. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity. And so it's been almost a year in this particular position. And yeah, that's kind of a really long, rambling answer to your question, but that's sort of how I ended up in the space I am now.
Oh, man, I think it was perfect. And, you know, that's a big journey to try to talk about, you know. So I think I would have been upset if you would have cut a lot of corners, because based on our call a few weeks ago, you nailed everything that I was hoping you would say in that, because it's so important. And if you're feeling a certain way, there are other people out there feeling the exact same way you are. So, you know, Steve and I made the decision early on, and we've mentioned it a few times. whoever you need to hear the message from listening to the show, we want to have that person on the show. We can talk about it from a science perspective, from a wellness perspective, applied perspective, all day long. But when someone that looks like you, sounds like you, has been through what you've been through, can say and do things, it matters. I love everything you just said, Sav. I think that every experience you've been through along that journey has led you to where you're at, and not only led you there, but armed you for anything that you've faced, and, you know, made you the complete person that can really make an impact in the industry. And I've said it all along, as we move forward with this and nature becomes a bigger piece of health and well-being, we're going to have to continue to turn to these outdoor brands and companies that we've always looked to as a leader in this movement. And you can see it with other companies as well. A lot of their advertisement right now, and, you know, smart people can figure things out. And some of it, unfortunately, can feel a little check the box once in a while, but honestly, you can tell sincere messaging. And that's one thing about this company that I've always appreciated, is that they walk the talk and they don't do a whole lot of self-promotion. Yeah, they do ads. I see stuff on social media, you know, but I had the chance to sit down with Simon Perkins, the, you know, the head of the Orvis company last fall, and I was blown away when he was telling me things that I never knew about the company and the initiatives that they have. And he spoke just so highly of you and the initiatives that you're involved in. And it was just, it was great. So to see that there are companies out there and organizations out there that, let's be honest, don't have to do this, doing this work and doing it so sincerely, it's pretty special. I love that you said 6 months and you were there 16 years. I'm glad you brought that up, because community is such a huge piece of the wellness world right now, and finding a healthy and safe community and building strong communities. And I mean, it's all over Netflix with the Blue Zones show that's taken it by storm. And I think that what I heard in you saying that was that you showed up somewhere and instantly found your community and you leaned into it and embraced it. And I think all of us have the opportunity to do that. It doesn't have to be across the country. There, you know, Steve and I talk a lot about finding our people. And if you're a mountain biker, go somewhere where your people congregate. If you're a fly angler, if you're a hunter, if you're a hiker, you know, I love going to places like REI, even if I'm not going to buy anything, because I'm surrounded by other outdoor people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I hear words that make me happy, and I hear, you know, conversations that I want to be a part of. And, you know, so just proactively finding those opportunities and the barriers to access. I mean, there's so much we could unpack in what you said, and hopefully we can touch on a lot of these points. But, you know, Steve, what do you think so far? This, I told you before Sav got on the call, I told you we've been so blessed to have the caliber and the variety of guests on our show that we've had. And I said, get ready. Here's another one.
Yeah. I mean, I was excited because I realized I just happened to have the Orvis December 2023 holiday gift guide on my table here next to me. And as you know, as you were talking, I picked it up and I started looking at it, and I was kind of trying to pick it apart or trying to look at it, trying to be, you know, critical of the marketing that I'm seeing in front of me. And I just realized that I didn't have much to be critical about. Actually, it seems like
that's good to hear.
That's right. Yeah. It was focused on the products. I saw that there's a huge range and variety of sizes to help accommodate hopefully all sizes and shapes of human. And there's a huge, huge, huge just diversity of offering in the holiday gift guide this year. And so anyway, it was just something I thought was kind of funny and quirky that happened to be sitting on my table. It came in the mail, I think, just earlier this week. I'm really, really curious about like your job, like, you know, the nuance, the unique perspectives that hopefully, I mean, you all are bringing to the table to help this very, very old company modernize maybe a little bit. I don't know if that's an appropriate word. You tell me.
Sure, I think that's fair. Yeah, so it's interesting. There's probably five different points between what you both said that I want to touch on. But, you know, to answer your specific question about the job, it's one of the things that I love about it is that it's super dynamic, and that's by design. My position is very broad in scope. And again, it goes back to this idea of this work really being centered at the core of what we do. So I would say outside of our executive leadership, I probably have the most holistic view of what Orvis does as a whole. So Orvis is a very multifaceted company, right? So we have You know, certainly we sell direct to consumer. We have 80 some retail stores around the country. And of course, we have a huge wholesale business too, right? So there's lots of independent retailers all over the country that are selling our product. We also, you know, do a lot of our own manufacturing, right? Like our American built rods are something we're very proud of. And we own that manufacturing facility in Vermont. Our warehousing, you know, we have a huge facility in Virginia where all of that stuff happens. And so all of those ecosystems are very different. And the needs of each of those ecosystems are different. The type of associates that work in each of those ecosystems are different. And so for someone in my position who is really responsible for making sure that that culture gets inculcated in all of those places, that doesn't happen unless I have touch points in each of those places. So, you know, every day is different. Ostensibly, what I do is sort of HR adjacent. But it's not really HR in that sense. You know, people and culture is much bigger than that. It's sort of the foundation upon everything that happens at a company, you know, gets built on. So I might be interacting with our brand experience teams, our creative teams, our marketing teams one day. You know, are we being thoughtful about not just who's in front of the camera, but who's behind it, right? You mentioned size inclusivity. That's certainly something I'm thinking about. And so in that vein, maybe I'm interacting with our sourcing teams and our product design teams. You know, I might be doing something one day that is, you know, very strategic and looks at things from a very high level. And then, you know, my very next meeting might be something that is, you know, very specific to one of those ecosystems that I talked about. So every day is different. The skill set that's involved is really varied. You know, one of the things that attracted me to this position is I've always been someone who values learning a lot of different disciplines. And, you know, I detest being referred to as like a Renaissance man or something like that. That's a label for somebody else. I'm really just more like I can't focus on anything for long enough.
I got you. I told you, Steve, he's our people.
Yeah, but you leverage that aspect of your personality, right?
Yeah.
For good.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. So to be good at this, you sort of have to be a little bit of a polymath. Like you have to have skills in a lot of different areas. You know, you have to be someone who just loves interacting with people ultimately, because that's what it comes down to. And to me, that's the most exciting part of the job is I get to experience all of these different aspects of the work that we do. You know, I get to experience all of these different places in which that work happens. And ultimately, all of that is to serve this larger goal of creating an internal culture that gets reflected back out to the customer, that Orvis is all about helping you experience the adventure and wonder in nature. You know, that's our mission statement. And I feel that very acutely to my core, because that's the thing that has meant the most to me, right? So I feel so fortunate to be able to do this work, because it is something that's, I think, unique in the industry to this point, to create a position like this that is so broad in scope, but also very specific in purpose, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, you said something that I don't want to pass by without addressing. You mentioned that your role is HR adjacent. And I talk about this constantly with wellness programs. And HR sometimes becomes a dumping ground for really important work and programming because, A, let's be honest, these are looked at as fairly new programs in the workplace. So we don't know what we don't know. So let's just dump it somewhere. And we saw that working with the military too, Steve. Additional duties, right? So I think that wellness programs should collaborate with HR, definitely, but they should be under someone who is a subject matter expert and independent to be able to touch all aspects of a company. Same with any sort of equity and inclusion and belonging programs. You know, diversity shouldn't belong to one person in the organization, especially as an additional duty. It should be something that everybody shares. And that's one thing I've heard you talk about this entire time is how supported you've been. I mean, you were working in a retail store, correct? and you showed interest and they brought you up to the level you're at and supported you every level of the way and said, this is important enough that we want to do it the right way. We're not just going to bring someone in to do a seminar here and there. And nothing wrong with that. But, you know, life happens and 6 weeks later, you might forget some of the stuff that you hear in that seminar, no matter how important it is.
Sure.
As someone who delivers those seminars and workshops, I get it. But building it, and you use one of my very favorite all-time words, Sav, inculcate. And I don't hear that enough. I use it all the time. But if you can really build it into the fabric of the culture of the organization to where it's not just another thing, it's our thing. And it's our consistent thing. It's part of our culture, our identity, you know, every move that we make, that's how it gets staying power. That's how it gets teeth. That's how it gets digested by everybody and used appropriately. And again, you know, I know it's not just the leadership that has made this happen with their support. A lot of it is coming from your passion. And, you know, just talking to you twice now, you ooze that passion. And I think that if you can marry that passion with the support, with purpose, it's magical. So I just want to applaud you and everybody that's associated with what you're doing in that company, because it's, you know, I talk a lot about this stuff and very rarely do I get this type of feedback about support and programming. So very, very well.
Yeah, no, I feel very lucky to be in that situation. You know, you mentioned Simon and, you know, Simon is an incredible leader, someone who I'm very proud to stand behind. And he and I have had a lot of conversation over the years about this work. And he was certainly, you know, instrumental in helping me get to where I am now. And it's interesting, Simon would hate to know that I'm giving him props because he's the type of leader who shies away from the spotlight.
Yeah, he's a very humble guy.
He is. And he has a saying that I think is very central to how we operate as an organization. And certainly how I operate within the scope of the work that I do. And that is be, do, say in that order. And so you talked about how this work has been done in some ways quietly. And the quiet work, especially within the scope of this work, is really important. As you said, as it became part of the zeitgeist, you saw lots of advertising become more representative, which is great and is a step in and of itself, but it needs to be authentic. It really needs to be reflective of the culture of the organization. And I think there's a keen awareness of that at Orvis. There's a lot more being done than gets talked about. And honestly, we're at a place now where I feel like we should be a little bit louder about some of the successes that we've had. And, you know, I think that is the end product of a lot of thought, a lot of intentionality. And that's the way that this work gets done in a really important way.
I don't mean to diminish any of the outward exposure to this type of work. I mean, you've got an amazing content and marketing department there. Some are close friends of mine. And I think that you guys are masters of telling stories. We had James Samsel on last season.
Oh, James is amazing.
Yeah. And the 12-minute film that Orvis endorsed through that, it was amazing. So I think you guys are master storytellers. The moments of chill, I've always loved those. You know, there's so many different things that come out of those departments that are just masterful. And storytelling is the earliest form of communication. That is the way that we communicate with one another consistently. And you guys do a great job of that. But I do understand what you're saying. But I think that in subtle ways, you guys continue to lead the way. I mean, Steve's saying, I tried to pick apart this catalog and I couldn't. It's not just hiring models that look a certain way. This is a core belief.
Right.
And I think that that's very apparent. And, you know, my conversation with Simon was incredible. And just seeing everything since that point, immediately, like the James film, like meeting Darrell, meeting yourself. I mean, these are like genuine and honest steps and beliefs. This isn't lip service. This is the zeitgeist, like you mentioned. This is, you know, this is walking the talk. And I encourage every brand, every company, if you're involved, walk the talk. We're in a time and place now socially where if you're BSing, people are going to know that pretty quickly and they're going to move on. So if a company is diverse, it's just a good business model too. I mean, let's be honest. We talk about capitalism a lot on the show and how we can't avoid it.
Sure.
You know, being diverse, it's great. And I mean, listen, I appreciate everything you said about your background and growing up in central Pennsylvania in a rural area. And I grew up in a, you know, a tiny little town in Kentucky. And I was on the other side of your story. My family background is mixed. I have diversity in the bloodline, but I identify as a white male. So there was very few families of color in my town growing up. I love everybody, Sav. I really do. And I got chastised for that sometimes, you know, and to see where we've come in an outdoor industry. And, you know, I can't even imagine what that was like growing up in that area. But I can imagine the fact that nature was a solace. Nature was, as we always say, that great equalizer. It doesn't care about things like race or identity or gender or money or where your parents are from. It doesn't matter. Nature is just always there for all of us. It doesn't ask us for anything. So I can absolutely see how your journey has unfolded in a way that has made you so passionate about helping other people enjoy the outdoor world in a safe and continuous way. So not that you need accolades. I know you well enough by now to know that, just like you said about Simon, you're going to poo-poo this away as well. But please know genuinely, and I mean this sincerely, thank you for what you're doing. You know, it's completely in line with what Steve and I talk about every single day, getting more people comfortable with being outside because nature is for all of us.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate the kind words. And you know, I think there's a couple things you mentioned there that I think are worth touching on. And, you know, earlier in the show, we were talking about just the value of like finding community and how important that is. Mm-hmm. And I think what we need to be aware of is that the flip side of that is being exclusionary, right? And being tribalistic and saying, if you don't belong to my community, then, you know, XYZ. So I think beyond finding community, it's finding intentional community.
Love that.
And it's about like the thing that drives me is mirrored at the company as well. Is everything we do is very relationship based. You know, we value that really highly. And, you know, something I've heard you guys talk about on the show before is this idea of breaking spiritual well-being down into values, relationship, and purpose. And I've loved that. When I heard that on the show, it just really resonated for me because that is very much the way we try to approach things at Orvis and certainly how I try to approach things within the scope of just my own life too. It's, for me, connecting my values to the relationships that I value is what gave me purpose. So I love that kind of trinity of things, you know, they just make sense to me. And I think the other thing that I want to bring up, and this is again, something I've heard you guys talk about on the show. I'm a big fan of the show, by the way.
I was going to say, I'm humbled that you're out there. You keep referring back to the show, man. I'm blown away.
Another thing that I think is really important is this ties into community too, but like the social aspects of wellness and the idea that what we do together, we do well. And this just makes so much sense to me because that's what my personal mission is all about. It's all about bringing others along. It's about, you know, showing and reimagining what the pathways are to engage with the outdoors, which, as you said, is the great equalizer, right? It's there, it's available for everyone. And that's not to diminish the fact that there are very real barriers to accessing outdoors for various communities. And, you know, the specificity of what I do is kind of tied into that. But that being said, in some fashion, this is something that's accessible to everyone and, or should be. And the thing that makes it worthwhile is being able to do it with others and to make sure that there's as diverse a community involved is paramount to making sure that it continues. You know, something that we talk about a lot, not just at Orvis, but, you know, you mentioned my involvement with Minority Outdoor Alliance, and this is something that's very central to the work that we do there, is, you know, the kind of the tagline for Minority Outdoor Alliance is basically creating an inclusive outdoors, bringing the unlikely to the outdoors. And so it's this idea of building a bridge. And I should say there's a lot of value in affinity spaces, being able to experience the outdoors in a space that feels safe to you, whether that is you're talking about racial affinity spaces or, you know, gender and sexuality, or you guys talked a lot at the top of the show about the veterans population, you know, all of these things, those affinity spaces are really important. And then the next step is connecting those affinity spaces to the ecosystem at large. And what happens is when you have the largest possible number of voices in that conversation, everyone, you know, it's the old adage, right? Rising tide lifts all ships. It right. sounds really cliche, but it's true, right? So you go, a lot of this is kind of very high level, and we talk kind of at a very conceptual level a lot of times in this work, but you have to be able to connect it to something that's quantitative. And where the rubber meets the road there is when you think about what the actual tangible issues are when it comes to experiencing the outdoors, whether that's changes in our climate, in weather patterns, in conservation and sustainability policy, you know, and all of these institutional barriers, and, you know, the list goes on. But there are things that are very tangible within our society that need to be addressed. And those conversations only benefit from having a diverse set of voices. And, you know, we talk about that a lot in the fishing and hunting industries, how our pursuits connect to conservation and how they connect to protecting the places that we love, making sure that they exist for future generations. And all of that rhetoric is well and good. And if we really want to walk the walk of those conversations, we need to make sure that the people that are involved are as diverse as possible.
Right.
And I should say that I think a lot of times in when people hear DEI work or anything like that, it unfortunately gets overly politicized. And sometimes there are kind of barriers that get put up. But if you look at the core of what this work really is, it's just that. It's making sure that we have the most diverse group of people having that conversation. And that's all sorts of diversity, whether it be racial diversity, gender equity, neurodiversity,
ability levels,
folks who are differently abled.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, there are a lot of different aspects to it. And I think to me, that's what's exciting about this work, the ability to be able to connect all of those dots. And I think that the conversation just gets far more rich when you have all of those different perspectives. And I think when it works the best, it demonstrates some of the nuance that gets lost in so much of our conversation in modern society. Everyone wants, and it's a very human thing, right? To want things to be very binary. There's right and wrong and on any particular issue, but we all know that the interesting parts are the gray, the stuff that happens in the middle. And, you know, I think there's importance in recognizing that some of this work creates discomfort, and it should. You know, that area of discomfort is often where the most growth happens.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And leaning into that is important, but it doesn't have to be hard.
I say that every day, Seb.
We make it hard, right?
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is the thing that makes the most difference on an individual level is, do you love to fish, hunt, hike, yeah, go outside, walk at a park, whatever? Ask someone to come along with you. Like, that's ultimately like the crux of the issue, is creating a culture in which that's the expectation and not the outlier. It's this idea of just, this is something that you're passionate about. Like, why wouldn't you want to share it with other people?
Sure. I mean, that's how we've made it this far as a species, right? We've shared, we've collaborated, we gathered around a fire and had communal meetings. That's how we've made it. And we're getting further away from that. And I know that the World Health Organization just put out a bunch of stuff within the last couple of weeks about what we've been talking about here in the States for quite a while now with Dr. Murthy and the pandemic of loneliness. And now the World Health Organization is saying, no, it's everywhere. It's across all age groups, all, you know, ethnic backgrounds. We're really getting further and further apart from one another. And here's how it's detrimental to our health. And I think exactly what you're saying, it's getting people out there. It's together. It's the more people we can get singing out of the book of music, the more we remember the songs. You know, I know we're going to talk about music in a minute. That's a phrase I use all the time. You know, we don't have to be on the same page. Let's just all figure out the same book and get there together eventually. But I think back to, I think I mentioned this in the intro, it starts with just hearing each other, like honestly listening without an agenda. And I think so many of our problems could be solved there. And I know a lot of my work, I see that happening more and more when I can do it outside of people of all backgrounds, all ability levels, all identities. When I get them out in the nature, I don't know what it is. It just lifts away some of that veil and some of that garbage that gets between A and B in that communication.
Some of the ego.
Right.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Ego is gone, right? And you've historically really leaned into activities that even in perception have been dominated by a single race or identity, right? And not just fishing, fly fishing, especially fishing, hunting, but bluegrass. And I would love to switch to music for a minute. You know, being from that small Kentucky town, you know, I grew up on Bill Monroe and Doc Watson, and I grew up not far from Clinch Mountains. So the Clinch Mountain boys, and, you know, then Ricky Skaggs and all, you know, but again, they all looked exactly the same as far as diversity. I know that bluegrass is just like country music and other genres is undergoing a surge right now in celebrating diversity, which, you know, is being met with different levels of acceptance, but we're getting there, I think. I know there are other bluegrass artists like Trey Wellington, who extremely talented banjo player, who are just shining a light on the fact that just like with music and wellness and nature, music is for everybody. And we've talked about this with a few former guests, but can you talk about that journey with music and how you ended up in the bluegrass genre?
Yeah. So a couple of things before I kind of launch into my personal journey to bluegrass that I want to throw out there. The first of which, and this goes for bluegrass music, and, you know, there's crossover into what we were talking about in the outdoors as well, is that you talk about how they have kind of historically been dominated by one group. And there's a couple things there. One is that's certainly true, but also there's value in recognizing that that's by design.
Sure.
And I think that there's also value in recognizing that that was not always the case. So this is something I talk about a lot in kind of both worlds that I exist in, is the fact that cultures all around the world have had sporting traditions for thousands of years. So there's certainly value in reconnecting some of these underinvested communities to the outdoors, to music, to culture, whatever. And so certainly like the kind of the learn to hunt, the learn to fish events are great. But what gets lost in that conversation oftentimes is the representation of all of the hundreds or sometimes thousands of years of history that those communities have had that have influenced those pursuits.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that's interesting to me about bluegrass, and one of this kind of my entree into it, is that it is very much a music of identity. It's very young art form, right? It's bluegrass is about 80 years old. I think that's something that people who are not as familiar with it don't realize. And it is an amalgam of a lot of different cultural influences, right? So you have the improvisational aspect of jazz, which hopefully anyone who has any knowledge of jazz understands that it itself, of course, is a group of different influences, but heavily, heavily influenced by African-American music. The same can be said for bluegrass, right? So you have the kind of the ballad tradition coming from the British Isles that gets, you know, synthesized into bluegrass. You know, you have just the instrumentation itself is, you know, we could go down rabbit holes talking about the history of each of the instruments that get involved in modern bluegrass instrumentation and how they came to be. But it's really interesting because I think it's a great mirror to culture. So for me personally, what attracted me to it was I was at a place in my life where, just like the outdoors, I was looking for something that solidified my view of what it was to be an American, and more specifically, what it was to be Appalachian, because that's something that I feel is very central to my identity. So despite the fact that it is a music that really takes influences from coast to coast, in the cultural zeitgeist, at least, it has this connection to Appalachian culture. And certainly there's a lot of that that gets put into it. And so for me, it was a way to express my ownership over my own identity, right? So there are all of these external forces that were trying to tell me that the things that I felt connected to, whether it be the outdoors, the themes that get explored in bluegrass are really very universal, right? There are lots of things that connect to the immigrant experience mm-hmm. as well. So there's lots of songs about leaving home, right? And sense of place and, you know, being connected to a piece of land as part of your identity and love and loss. And all of these things are very central to the immigrant experience. So there are so many parallels to the things that I was experiencing. And at the same time, it was a way to kind of plant a flag for me to say, this is as much mine as it is anyone else's. And there's also, you know, you talked about ego, like there's a little bit of ego involved too, of like, well, you say that I can't do this. I'm not only am I going to do it, I'm going to strive to do it at a professional level. And so there's a little bit of that, you know, just personal, like, don't tell me what I can and can't do.
Right? We've all been there. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. But it comes, honestly, you know, I joke about it, but there's a piece of, again, the immigrant experience, particularly within American culture, that gets tied back to this idea of determination and grit. Goonies never say die.
Love it. Oh, man.
You have to not prove yourself. That's not really the right word, but to excel in ways that contextualize your own experience. And there's some of that that can be really damaging. And it's important to call that out, you know, especially as an Asian American, there's, you know, this idea of the model minority myth. And that's been extremely damaging to our communities and certainly something that I've internalized and have worked to break out of. But the flip side of that is that there is this opportunity for anyone who wants to be involved in any pursuit to do so and to do it at a high level. And I just found that really enticing. And so that was my entry point to it, was here's something that I feel like, and I've always been involved in music. I was classically trained as a vocalist. So music was already a big part of my identity. But then to be specific about this is the music that resonates for me because it speaks to my experience in different ways. And it might be in a different way than someone else experiences it. But the through line is there. The themes are there that are really resonant. That was initially how I got to love it. And then, you know, going back to the community aspect, I think there's something really special about the fact that this is a genre of music, A, that you will see just as many, if not more, people in the audience at their campsites playing music as you do on stage. It's a participatory music by design. And the influence of the ballad tradition coming over from the British Isles, this is an oral tradition being passed from one generation to the next. And so that aspect gets passed on into what is now modern bluegrass, in the sense that there is a participatory aspect of it. And you don't have to go to the level of playing at the professional level, but no matter what your, you know, ability, you can participate. You can be a piece of this cultural tradition. And I think that's really powerful. I think that it, again, kind of goes back to speaking to the American experience of, you know, we are a participatory culture. The underpinnings of our governmental system, as many flaws as it may have, was ultimately saying, no, a system in which you have, whether it be a figurehead or, you know, kind of an ultimate power, that's not going to work for us. Like, we want to have a say. And so there's some parallels there to how the music happens too. So that aspect of it is really important to me. And then the community aspect, you know, this is a, again, it's a cultural marker for me. And I think it is for a lot of people that are involved. And so again, you're finding that shared passion that can connect you to a variety of different people. And, you know, there are examples of communities all over the world that play bluegrass music at a very high level. And the industry organization, the International Bluegrass Music Association, is kind of the, you know, the main industry organization. And the first letter of that acronym is important. The fact that this is, although albeit a very American art form in creation, is something that belongs to everyone. And so, you know, just to kind of put a through line to the work that I do, there again, it's all about just bringing people along and exposing people to the depth of it. You know, it does have, I think, a preconceived notion by people who are not aware of it that it is simplistic or, you know, again, all those words, but backwards or whatever. And the reality of it is it's an incredibly complex form of art, and it is extremely difficult to execute at a high level. The musicianship is out of this world.
It's very complex.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, it, once again, it's all about these barriers that people have, these stereotypes that people have about A, what the pursuit is, and B, what does someone look like that pursues it? And so, again, a little bit of an ego piece. I feel like I get off a little bit on subverting people's expectations.
Well, you're an educator, Sav. That's what I'm hearing. Everything you do professionally with music, you're educating people. And that goes back to what I said a minute ago about the perception of bluegrass belonging to certain groups of people. And it is a melting pot of musical styles. And it is so complex and diverse. It really is. And I think that, you know, things like our conversation with Joe Maylander last year, Steve, and talking about the participatory aspect of their concerts and their shows and being there and seeing it. And, you know, the banjo is one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do in my life. I mean, it is completely complex. And to watch somebody like even Steve Martin, who just absolutely kills it, it's a beautiful thing, you know. And I've watched so much concert footage of you and the band playing, and I'm just always just enamored by the skill level that you guys bring to this, and the harmonies and the vocals. And you mentioned the style from the British Isles. And I mean, again, that's storytelling. All of these aspects are storytelling coming together to tell a story of all of us. And when it's grouped into one type of person, I think that's where media was. You mentioned 80 years. If you think back to media representation 80 years ago, and it was dominated by one type of person. So I think that's where a lot of that came from. But if you watch the Okie Dokie Brothers mini doc Through the Woods, they do a lot of exploring different musical styles of Appalachia, and even talk about the difference between saying Appalachia and Appalachia, depending on where you're at in the region. You know, I grew up in the area where, you know, if you get it wrong, I'll throw an Appalachia. That's how you remember yeah. it and say it.
That's it.
And so, you know, just listening to that and seeing all of the diverse styles that come together to form mountain music, and all the different groups that were settled in that area when it came together. It was, I mean, I know that I get lumped into some of those categories you mentioned just because of where I'm from. Being from that small town in Appalachia, I'm looked at as maybe being slower, or admittedly, I worked hard to get rid of my accent a long time ago because people kept judging me in ways that were very uncomfortable. But I can't tell you how diverse that area used to be and still is in a lot of ways, just not what others perceive outside of there.
Right.
So I think that your education is important.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't know that, I mean, certainly within the scope of my professional role, you know, there's some intentionality to that. But I think up to that point, it wasn't necessarily intentional in the sense of I wasn't saying to myself, I'm going to go out there and educate people about all the things that I just listed. But it was more, I was going through that education myself. Like, I found so much interest in discovering the richness of Appalachian culture through this lens. And, you know, I think it's interesting you mentioned about losing your accent, which is something I've heard from, you know, a lot of people. And certainly coming from an immigrant family, you know, language is such a cultural marker. And it's interesting how that changes, how that experience changes, you know, just in recent weeks, things that have happened in current events. This is a conversation that my family and I, you know, have had many times. And something that I think about is just the idea of like speaking our native language in public. And does that make you a target? And that in and of itself is, you know, is a cultural marker, right? And then also, again, this is part of my personality. I kind of like the subversive aspect of like, no, if that's the case, that just makes me want to do it even more, mm-hmm. right? And so I think for you to be in that space where you felt like you had to extinguish that part of yourself to give yourself some sort of cachet, I think that is something that is really interesting and you should lean into because it's something that I've done certainly. So, you know, like we all, to some extent, I think regardless of your lived experience, we all code switch, right? Depending on what our surroundings are and all of that. And there are lots of different ways in which that can be useful. But I think that there's also a great value in having the confidence to not feel like you have to do that. And I think that's at the core of what I do professionally and personally is like, because I spent so much time trying to figure out what aspects of myself were quote unquote acceptable and trying to push that forward in any given situation. And the stress that's involved in that is huge. And, you know, just the freeing aspect of inhabiting yourself in a really authentic way, I think is something that's really important, especially like, you know, as we talk about wellness, like that's something that's very core to just how you present in the world, right?
Well, and that's part of why we're in this problem that we're in right now socially is because we're comparing ourselves to everybody constantly. Social media has been a juggernaut of damage on that, just constantly feeling like we don't fit in enough or we're not good enough. So we kind of retreat and then we just sit around all day and scroll and compare. And I think that's damaging. And I appreciate everything you said. And, you know, that's a part of me that I've been reflecting on for a while. This happened in high school when I moved from Kentucky to Florida. And I got tired of people saying, hey, come say something. We want to hear you talk. It was an ongoing thing. And are you sure you understand that? You know, maybe speak slower for him or whatever else. When I sing, I can't control it. When I sing, I'm as country as a dirt clod, and I love it.
Absolutely. As you should be.
Yeah, and I don't mind that at all. And I don't mind when it does come out. If I'm around people from back home, it comes out, and I don't apologize for it. And Steve, I know we've talked about this as well, you know, with different aspects of your background culturally and through your time in the military and different things. And you know, it's a shame that we feel like we have to conform. It's a shame that we feel like we all want to be unique and different and validated, but all we do is try to conform to other people's, to you know, to the whole and feel like we belong. And I think all of these things we're talking about, music, wellness, nature, it's just a place for us to be. And I say it all the time, Sav, nature is the one place I can just be Mark. You know, it has no expectations for me. I don't have to carry a title. I don't have to say, please call me Mark, not Dr. Campbell. I'm not Mark who did this or Mark who's worked here or whatever. I'm just Mark. And I can't get enough of that. And I find myself being drawn to being outside for that reason. I just want to be me,
yeah.
You know, and that's the one place I can do it. And
as I'm hearing you talk about that, I think that's one of the things that drew me to the outdoors in the first place. You know, there were all of these other things that we've talked about, but I think from a very base level, at a time in my life when I was living under that stress that I was talking about of trying to formulate who I was as a person, here was a space in which all of those pressures disappeared. And this is something I still struggle with every day, right? And I have a quote on my little whiteboard here just to remind myself about that all the time. And it comes from the Bhagavad Gita, right? The ancient Hindu epic. And the translation, it says, it's better to live in your own destiny imperfectly than to live an imitation of somebody else's life with perfection.
Wow.
And I just think that that is so powerful. And it has resonated with me in my life so many different ways, which is why I keep it right next to my desk and I look at it every day, because it's all about that. And I hate the word authenticity. I think it's very loaded.
Yeah, it gets misused all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it can give the impression that there's a singular way in which someone can be authentic and whatever. But sometimes it's just a good word for the time, but it's about being that authentic self. It's about being true to not the singular thing, but it's this, going back to my work, right? One of the key concepts within DEI work is intersectionality. So no one exists in a vacuum. You are the product of all of your lived experiences, you know, and there are lots of different things that feed into that. But whatever that is, that amalgam of those different influences that make you who you are, if you can learn to inhabit that, other people respond to that. You know, I think that's why I've been able to do the work that I do. It's not a reflection on me. I'm just a mirror for other people. And, you know, I've just been so blessed to have the opportunity to reflect that mirror to a lot of really interesting and capable people. And I think if anything, that's what I feel the best about.
I love that so much. And, you know, I know that you've been very gracious in offering to share some of your music with us. And we're going to include a clip from the band that you play with. And can you tell us a little bit about the song leading up to it?
Yeah. So I should mention the name of the band is Unspoken Tradition. And we're based right here in Western North Carolina. We tour all over the country. And this this song is one that was released as a single this past year. We were really grateful that it's done really well for us and hit the charts and all that stuff. But the reason I chose it is I think that it illustrates a lot of the things that we're talking about today. It's a song called Moments, and it's one that talks about the fleeting nature of moments in your life, but then also how central they can be. And I think that speaks really strongly to what we're talking about, the moments that we share with other people in the outdoors and how powerful they can be in our life. And so I thought it was really appropriate.
Oh man, I can't wait. I can't wait. And actually, I've heard Moments. I love Moments. I think that I follow you guys on social media. I love your posts from different bluegrass events. I get really excited about it. I kind of geek out about it, admittedly. So
thanks for listening.
Absolutely, man. And I encourage everybody else to as well. And we're going to put all of the band information in the show notes as well. So please check them out. Please enjoy the song. It'll be right after the interview concludes. So stick around for that. And Sav, I know we could talk about this for the next 6 hours, man. Honestly, this is, I know you said we'll get as deep as you want. And I know we could get deeper and I want to get deeper. I just think, as Steve and I have said before, it just means we're going to have you back on and keep this conversation going. But I would love to, if you're okay with it, switch to the part of the show we call the Fast Five, where we ask you five quick questions and answer as quickly as you can. You ready for that?
Okay. Absolutely. Right. Bring it on.
What's your favorite place to get outside?
Oh, gosh. That's really tough because they've been lucky enough to have outdoor experiences all over and there's value to all of them. But, you know, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is the importance of that sense of place. There's nothing better for me than getting out in the grouse woods here in Southern Appalachia. There's a gravitas to some of the oldest mountains in the world. And so I think if there's one thing that can be said about me when I'm gone, if they can say I was Appalachian, I think that would be the thing. So that, I've got to go with that.
I love that so much. And I know Darrell invited us down to Georgia to do some grouse work, and we're going to have to make that Southern trip, and we'll definitely be stopping by.
Yeah, Nashville. Man, I'm going down to quail hunt with Darrell next week. So yeah. Come on down. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, I wish I could. I'd love to. I'll get down there sometime. What is your preferred outdoor activity?
Ooh, another tough one. I mean, obviously fly fishing is central to my journey. I love to fly fish, but it would probably be a tie between that and upland bird hunting. I love, love, love working with bird dogs. And it's not about the hunt. It's about watching the dogs work and that partnership that you build with your dog. I've got both my dogs sleeping on the floor behind me here. You know, they're my coworkers as well. But yeah, I mean, I love that. And similarly, just the experience of standing in a trout stream is so important. I have a brook trout tattooed on my arm, and it's, you know, it's Appalachia's native dominant species. That's one of the reasons I chose it. It's both the native trout species of North Carolina, where I made my home, and Pennsylvania, where I grew up. You know, it's again, just a cultural marker for me. It's a way of claiming my identity. So yeah, brook trout fishing is definitely right up there too.
You're singing in my heart now, buddy. What's your favorite food to eat outside?
That's such a tough question.
They only get harder.
Yeah, I love to eat. I am definitely a foodie, love fine dining, love all kinds of different ethnic foods, all that kind of stuff. But there's something really special about sitting on the tailgate of my truck and cutting a piece of summer sausage and like a hunk of cheese with my pocket knife, like as I'm taking a lunch break on a hunt or something like that. So of all the fine meals that I've had in my life, I would say that one is probably more connected to the outdoors than anything else.
I love it. And, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit, you know, how just being outside enhances all of your senses, and it can turn something that is normally looked at as maybe plain or mundane and just recreate it completely as an experience. So that's amazing.
And 100%.
I agree with you. I think I know the answer to this, but do you have a favorite animal?
Ooh. Man, because they're bringing the heavy hitters. It's really tough because the animal world, I think, is one of the reasons I got into the outdoors in the first place. And there are so many different animals that have played a part in my story. I mentioned the brook trout. I love rough grouse. You know, I think ultimately, I guess if I had to pick one, I would say rough grouse, because there are things about, and actually there's some parallels to brook trout here too, but the things that they need to survive and thrive are things that are indicative of the health of the ecosystem. So grouse, they need successional forest habitat. They need the forest to be able to establish their natural cycles of, you know, fire and regrowth and all of that stuff. Same thing with brook trout. You know, they need cold, clean water. They need healthy riparian zones. You know, all of this stuff that are markers for their species reflect how well we as stewards are doing for the ecosystem as a whole. So for that reason, that's probably why I would pick those.
I don't know if I've heard better reason, to be honest. And again, you're teaching, man, whether you think you are or not, or you're trying to, you're an educator through and through. This is usually the tough one. If you could only go to one outdoor spot for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh boy, that is a tough one. Well, I think that there is some real value in someone, I think especially in someone who has lived their life outdoors and had the opportunity to experience so many different places in the outdoors. There's a special place in your heart for the place that drew you to it in the first place, right? And where you found your love for whatever that pursuit is. And so if I didn't have anything to do but walk those grouse covers and trout streams, that, you know, the limestone trout streams in central Pennsylvania, the places where that spark was ignited for me, you know, just, it's a very like tangible experience that, you know, I can recall in all of my senses anytime I think about it, you know, the way that those hardwood forests smell in the fall with, you know, the slightly decaying leaves on the ground. And, you know, it was like you were talking about nature with its makeup off. I love that phrase.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, this, and, you know, not to sound basic, but I do love fall, you know, there are aspects of that I think that are so intrinsic to like what initially gave me joy in the outdoors. Like I said, those sights, the smells, the way that crisp autumn morning feels on your skin. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah. Oh, so great. So great. I'm right there. You painted a picture for me. I can see it. I'm there right now. I love it. One bonus question. Do you have a favorite nature quote, saying, or idiom?
Oh, okay. So this one was really hard for me. So full disclosure, Mark did give me this question ahead of time so I would be prepared, because he knew that I would flounder if he sprung it on me.
Well, I just figured you'd have a bunch of them.
Yeah. Well, I do. And I had a really hard time picking just one. But the thing I landed on, I mentioned earlier in the show that I'm a voracious reader. I think books are a window to exploration in so many different ways. And in times when I have felt more often than not, aside from being outside, the solace I found was inside of a book. So I took this from one of my favorite authors, Jim Harrison, who writes, you know, about the outdoors in such a evocative way. And I think it speaks to everything we talked about today. And the quote is, "The wilderness does not make you forget your normal life so much as it removes the distractions for proper remembering."
Ooh.
And I think that is just so powerful. This idea that, and we were talking about it, right? Like, I don't want to escape the fact, like the dramatic irony of the fact that we're talking about this on a Zoom call, but the distance that we have from each other and from the things that connect us, those are all just barriers to remembering who we are as a species. And like, I find that is so evocative of like what I find exciting about the outdoors. When I go outside, I find myself again. And I think that quote illustrates it better than anyone I've ever heard.
That's amazing. That's unbelievable. Sav 2024, you got my vote.
Oh, Lord.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for all of this. And I can't wait to continue this conversation, hopefully for a very long time. Steve, what do you have for Sav before we go?
Well, one, gratitude, number one. You know, grateful you were able to make the time to spend with us. And number two is an appreciation for you as a continuous educator. And I find I empathize with that sentiment. And I find myself trying and working my hardest to also keep my mindset in that mentality, right? Of being willing to educate, being willing to share in an approachable way, and ensuring that those who are around me, right, I'm genuinely listening to them as well, right? And truly listening to listen, not listening to wait for an opportunity to speak, right? But listening to hear and digest, process. and then offer something maybe in return of value as well, rather than any other sort of potential offering. And so, but before we end, I wanted to make sure and touch on, because I was thinking back to some of the things that you shared with us earlier, like that are specific to the DEI concepts and vocabulary that are becoming a greater part, right, of our general lexicon today. You mentioned two terms that I want to make sure we define for our audience, especially some haven't heard these terms. You mentioned the term code switching, right, earlier. Mm-hmm. And there's a definition out there that anybody can find, you know, themselves on Google, but I wonder if this resonates with you. So I was going to read it real quick. Is it code switching is the ways in which a member of an underrepresented group, consciously or unconsciously, adjusts their language, syntax, grammar structure, behavior, and appearance to fit into the dominant culture, right? And that was a code switching definition that I pulled up real quick. Do you agree with that definition? Is that sort of similar context?
Yeah, I think that defines it really well. And, you know, I think that it's about presentation, right? It's about how you present in the world and the idea that it's necessary to present in a particular way to become a member of that majority culture, or to make yourself palatable to that majority culture.
Like what we do in a job interview, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's a great point. I mean, you know, the job market is certainly a place where a lot of those things happen. I mean, we hear it all the time, right? Like someone who has, like myself, who has a long, quote unquote, foreign sounding name, that resume gets overlooked for someone who has a more name that reflects the majority culture more often than not. You know, things, there are aspects of that are a big part of it. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a great definition. I think that's exactly what I was talking about.
And then there was one more that I wanted to touch on. And this one actually was brought up. I'm a grad student, finishing up grad school, coming up this year in 2024. And part of my focus is on rural community health, right? The major, major theme throughout it, right? We have rural communities everywhere and access to health, healthcare, understanding health status can be very, very challenging, right? It's just, you know, communication differences. I mean, provider differences. There's just so many nuances to a rural community. Sure. It's like a continuous challenge. Another term that we had mentioned earlier was intersectionality. And it was, I guess, originally brought up by a researcher, Kimberly Crenshaw, University of Chicago Legal Forum, back in the late 80s. And she defined intersectionality as the complex cumulative way in which the effects of multiple forms of discrimination combine, overlap, or intersect, especially in the experiences of marginalized individuals or groups, to produce and sustain complex inequities. Kind of a long definition, but necessary, right? In order for us to sort of try to unpack how these different aspects, right, of our personalities could combine in either a potentially overwhelmingly negative way or potentially even in a positive way, as long as we're willing to acknowledge them, right?
Acknowledgement, I think, is really the important piece there. Intersectionality, the kind of idea of intersectionality identifies that there are, as a kind of foundational understanding, there are multiple factors of both advantage and disadvantage that combine in any one person's experience. And it's a framework, right? It's a framework for understanding how those various social and political identities come together to, you know, create the expression of how that person exists in our society. And there's a lot to unpack. We could probably do a whole podcast just on intersectionality.
Yeah. I mean, haven't we today? I feel like that's the overarching theme right. of everything we've talked about, right?
Right. But, you know, but it is just that. It's an analytical framework. It's a way of viewing someone and certainly how someone can view themselves. It is not to say that it is the be-all, end-all, but it fills in some of those gaps in understanding in a way that I think is really important. You know, we talked about, you know, our need for things to be binary. And this is a way to break out of that. It's a thought experiment to be able to look at someone as a complex individual or a group of people as a complex group of people. And again, there's value in naming and acknowledging that different people have different sets of advantages and disadvantages. And that's a starting point for which to have the conversation.
Yeah. I didn't mean to derail our closing, Mark.
No, not at all, man.
I wanted to make sure, right, we touched on these terms. I think they're very powerful labels that bring a lot of value to conversations and help us and bring more people into these conversations, right? Because hopefully if they know we're willing to discuss these concepts, right, we're interested in helping others continuously define and redefine these concepts, right? It helps us meet our goal of expanding access to the outdoors for all, encouraging participation in outdoor environments for all, right? We want to break down walls. We don't want to put up any more walls. That was done by generations before us, right? And thankfully, it seems like current generation of humans is very excited to break down some barriers. And that makes me very excited every day. You know, I mean, America is going to be a minority majority country sometime by 2040, 2045. That means a lot of people are loving each other. Awesome. They're loving each other. They're procreating. They're helping create new cultures. And so these terms and the definitions of them, I think, are just exciting to discuss and to sort of do our best to unpack. And again, I'm grateful for your time today, Sav, because you really just inspire me.
Thanks for saying that, man. And likewise, you know, I think that we talked about it, but, you know, I mentioned it when we were talking about music, the idea that it's participatory, but like culture is participatory, right? Like we create the culture as we go. And so I think that's kind of what you're talking about. And, you know, I think it's a really exciting thing to be existing in this space at this time. And the opportunity, the responsibility that we have as leaders within this space to, you know, to weigh light, to show the pathways, to reimagine what those pathways are, to creating that culture and you know, creating one that reflects the culture that we want to see. It just doesn't get any better than that. Like, how could you want to be anywhere else or any other place? Like, it's just I think sometimes the conversation around these issues, and understandably, because there are lots of barriers and things that are difficult, it can be emotionally exhausting. It can be taxing. You know, something that I talk a lot about within the scope of being a DEI practitioner, you really have to be careful and you have to protect yourself because to do this work, you do have to be very emotionally open.
That's a great point.
Beyond that, though, the thing that drives me to do it, at least, like I don't want to speak for anybody else, but the thing that excites me is that idea. It's this idea that, like, I said it earlier in the show, what we do together, we do well, right? And it's like, how could you not want to be a part of that conversation? It's so exciting. Yeah, it's just, it's amazing. I feel so lucky to just have opportunities to talk to you guys. And like, this is what it's all about for me. So
yeah, I mean, that's the whole purpose behind the show. And to have these conversations as much as we do, I'm just overwhelmed sometimes. And I'm overjoyed at the same time. But I'll say this, I'm glad you brought up what you just said, both of you, actually. It's too important not to touch on. But what an exciting time we're living in. And I know that we get the negative parts shoved in our face constantly. And that's why we turn on the news. And they're very good marketers. They know how to pull the heartstrings and which emotions resonate more than others and how to keep us, you know, suckling at the media teat as often as we can. But we can't allow ourselves to forget that this is such an exciting time for change. And we all have that ability. And it's on us. It's not on our elected leaders. It's not on celebrities. It's not on the talking heads on the TV. It's on each one of us out there. And to know that there are people out there, Sav, like yourself, who are just walking this talk every day, it just fills me with so much hope and joy and excitement. And again, I don't want you to poo-poo that away. I want it to land the way it should. And I get these comments a lot too. And I like to deflect and say I'm part of the multivitamin, and we all are. But you know, it takes every part of that vitamin to really impact the system. And I just want you to know that you're doing that. And I can't thank you enough for just making the world a little bit better every day. And I couldn't mean that more. And thank you so much for giving us your time today. And we definitely want to have you back on, man. This has been spectacular.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thanks, Steve, for having me. It's been a joy. You know, as I said earlier in the show, the thing that gets me up out of bed and want to do this work every day is connecting with people. Ultimately, that's the facet of my personality that I think drove me to do this work, is I just think people are interesting ultimately. and I love being able to be in a position where I can mirror that, you know, back to them. So the same is true for this conversation. I've just had a blast, and thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's been our pleasure, man, honestly. And for everybody listening, please stay tuned for Moments by Unspoken Tradition. And until next time, do your health and well-being the biggest favor you can, and just get outside.
Memories and photographs may seem like little things to you, pieced together from the past, melodies that still ring true. Broken picture on the wall, she's still smiling through the glass. Does she remember me at all? It seems those moments never last. They turn us all around, lift us up or knock us down. Moments come on like moments make our stopped tonight. It hasn't moved in quite a while. The one that Mama used to want back when I was a child. Some would say that I'm a fool living through these souvenirs, but the moments that they dusty years. They turn us all around, lift us up or knock us down. Moments come on like a tide, put us on a path to push us to the side. That's the truth I've come to know, that's the way our story goes. Those moments make our lives.
Thank you for listening to the Nature of Wellness podcast, hosted by Dr. Mark A. Campbell and Steve Otero. Follow us on Instagram at Nature of Wellness, with new content being added frequently. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe wherever you listen. The content of this podcast is for general information purposes only. Nothing should be taken as legal or medical advice. The information is not intended to replace the guidance of your healthcare providers, but to create an outlet for new discussions with them.